Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome to episode 14 of the Ad Nauseam Podcast. As always, my name is David Noe. I'm here in the vomitorium with Dr. Jeff Winkle, my co-host. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing great today. How are you?
I'm doing real well. It's an evening, isn't it?
Yeah, this is rare for us.
Working late
in
the vomitorium.
First time. Yep. It's dark outside, but it's kind of a different vibe here in the vomitorium.
Absolutely. So we're preparing for a little bit of a holiday hiatus.
That's right.
So we thought we'd get a few recorded and in the can so that the listeners wouldn't miss a week.
That's right. The plan is to kind of keep it on the regular schedule.
Well, we don't want to interrupt their classical education.
Of course not. Who would want that?
Who would take a break from these fabulous Greek and Roman delights?
Exactly. No one's sane.
No. So what are we serving up tonight, Dr. Winkle?
Tonight, we're serving up death.
Okay.
It's all part of this smorgasbord.
So death is the gift that doesn't keep on giving, right?
Exactly right. But tonight, we are talking about the death of Cicero.
All right.
Yeah.
A date that will live in infamy. Is that how it goes?
That's right. Exactly. The first December 7th.
That's right.
To live in infamy. Yeah.
So I think it was December 8, 1941, former President Franklin D. Roosevelt referred to the attack on Pearl Harbor as a date which will live in infamy.
That's right.
And as it turns out, like you just said, Marcus Tullius Cicero, the Roman orator, was assassinated on December 7, 43 BC.
43 BC, right. So the plan is that this episode will drop, I believe, on December 8th.
That's right.
Right, so we try to do this as close to the anniversary of
exactly.
as possible. Yeah.
That's right. So the day, the anniversary of the day that FDR gave his speech, and one day after the anniversary of Cicero's unfortunate death.
How do you love that confluence?
It's really an easy mnemonic device. So that's how I always remember. When did Cicero die? December 7.
December 7.
So it has a dual meaning for some of us, you might say.
That's great. And now the audience has no excuse for never forgetting that.
For never remembering.
It's late here
all
in
right,
the vomitorium.
Jeff. So do we have a shout out this evening?
We do. This is Anthony Gibbons, a Latin teacher from Down Under.
Okay.
From Sydney, Australia, right?
Was that your...
No, it wasn't.
Okay. So Anthony's a listener of the podcast. He's keeping the torch lit by teaching Latin there in
Sydney.
Which
we appreciate. That's great.
Very grateful for your listenership. So let's get right into it, Jeff.
Let's do it. All right. Well, let's get into this with an opening quote here. And this is from Manfred Furman's book, Cicero in the Roman Republic, which is one of the better biographies.
I think it's my favorite.
Is your favorite one? Yeah.
Definitely. This was published in 1995. It was written in German, as the name might indicate, Manfred Furman.
Furman.
Translated then into English for us. Published by Wiley Blackwell.
All right. You want to read the quote for
yeah,
us
I
to
do.
Get started?
Yeah, I love this biography. On 7 December 43, Cicero suffered the same fate as, a year and 9 months earlier, had befallen the only other Roman of his time, who, in spite of all the differences between them, equaled him in stature. The fate of a violent death, which had previously struck down Pompey as well as Cato, and which was soon to strike Brutus and Cassius, and finally, 13 years later, Antony himself. The protracted crisis in Rome with its ceaseless civil wars, the transition from republic to autocracy, inexorably snatched the lives of those who had committed themselves to a cause with no thought of retreat. This is the interesting part. Certainly none of those we have mentioned had been as deluded as Cicero in the actions which led to their doom. On the other hand, it was his influence, both political and literary, which stood for something real, for the aristocratic Roman Republic which had evolved in the course of centuries. And so it was no mere coincidence that his life came to an end only 10 days after that 27 November when the rule of the Second Triumvirate began, putting an end forever to the constitution of the ancient Res Publica. More than the death of a Cato or a Brutus, Cicero's death symbolized the passing of republican freedom.
Oh, that's huge. So we're going to start here talking kind of a bit about Cicero's life and maybe more kind of specifically the general politics of the time which leads up to his death. But I'm just curious. You're the Cicero guy.
Mm-hmm.
You're much more of the Cicero guy than I am.
Right.
And when Furman says none of those we have mentioned had been as deluded as Cicero, what do you take that to mean? What's he getting at
there? I think that's accurate.
Okay.
And I think what he means by that is, right up until the end, Cicero had this strange belief, it seems, in the power of his own oratory and in the strength of the traditions which he represented.
So he thought that the system would ultimately
it would prevail.
Save itself.
Well, it had worked twice, right? Earlier in the century, the conflict between Sulla and Marius.
That's true.
Sulla
yeah.
had eventually triumphed and declared himself dictator in perpetuum.
That's right.
But then, and he had also brought a standing army into the city of Rome, something
right.
no one had ever done.
Yes.
Big taboo. But then Sulla laid down his dictatorship and retired, and the Republic resumed more or less normally.
That's right.
And it had happened a second time, right? After Pompey and Crassus and Julius Caesar had fought it out, and Julius Caesar had declared himself dictator in perpetuum in 46.
Right.
Hadn't laid it down, but then he was assassinated in 44.
Right, right,
and
right.
so it looked like, hey, things are going to continue.
But the third time was not the charm.
That's right, because okay. they couldn't count on a 19-year-old boy, right? Octavian,
right.
who later became Augustus. So he's the huge presence behind really this entire episode.
Gotcha, gotcha. So let's talk about kind of Cicero's role, or maybe in some ways almost lack of a role
right.
in these events that build up to the assassination of Caesar and then ultimately his own death.
Right. So we're going to have to devote a number of future episodes to Cicero because he's so important to Roman history.
Of course.
But tonight we're going to just skip over the basics of his biography very rapidly
right.
and get into some of the points that you'd like to touch on especially, which is how did Caesar and Cicero get along? Where did Cicero stand vis-a-vis Julius Caesar's policies and later then Augustus, Octavian?
Sure, right. Well, you know, from my reading and understanding and my own education is Cicero is remembered, and I think rightly so, as a diehard defender of the Republic, a believer in the Republic. But he also shows this willingness to push the envelope and to maybe conduct some things in an extra legal fashion if it serves his own interests.
I think that's right. And I think that Cicero's reputation as a legal mind, as a defender of the Republic, as a person of sincerity and genuine sentiment, that kind of reached its high point in the 19th century. And then Theodore Mommsen was largely responsible, a German scholar, for starting the takedown of Cicero.
In what kind of way? I mean, what is he picking?
Well, a lot of Cicero's ideas became less popular. He's advocating for a kind of freedom that doesn't correspond much to modern democratic ideas. By
of course,
any stretch.
Right, right.
It's not freedom for everyone. It's not freedom for women. It's not freedom for slaves. You have to be a freeborn landholding male
right.
to have the kind of freedom that Cicero is championing.
But if you consider him, you know, through the prism of his own day and age,
I think he's a champion of liberty.
Of course, right. If we're going to blame him for not living up to contemporary ideals, we might as well get mad at him for not recycling. Right.
That's a good point. In addition, for Cicero, unlike the other men of this time, we have a massive amount of his correspondence.
Right.
More than 1,000 letters.
So we know him better than pretty much any other figure from antiquity.
Well, and in some ways better than we'd like to. In one of his earliest letters, depending on how you read the text, he mentions the death of his father, and it's just an afterthought almost. It looks like, if the text is read properly, and there's not some kind of error in the Latin, it looks like a very callous kind of thing. He just
right.
mentions offhand, oh, and my father died, moving right along out of the purchase of my house.
Yeah.
So if we were to troll through the thousands and tens of thousands of emails that you've sent, Dr. Winkle, you wouldn't look quite as good as you do, you know, to me now.
Of course not, right. And that little anecdote reminds me of reading something about George Harrison, the Beatle.
He's the drummer, right?
No, come on now. Lead guitarist for the Beatles. So I was reading this thing about Harrison towards the end of his tenure with the Beatles. There was this picture in the book from his daily planner, and he had three things on there. It was something like, need to pick up the mail today. Number two, quit the Beatles. Three, need to pick up some bread and milk. And so just kind of very dismissive.
Right. Well, who doesn't have quit the Beatles on their to-do list?
Exactly right.
It's been on mine for many years.
Right. You're talking about this callous response to the death of his father. If you compare that to his response to the death of his daughter, however.
Completely different.
It destroyed him.
Yes. Of course, he was much older. And you can't just look at one letter of a man on a topic like this, because who knows whether they had talked about it before.
Of course.
Even though it's an expansive record, it's obviously incomplete.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. So Dave, run down just a quick biography of Cicero for us.
Okay, so I wrote my dissertation on Cicero, and I also checked Wikipedia.
Oh, wow.
So he was born in 106. He was from Arpinum. He was a novus homo, which means no one in his family had ever held the consulate.
A new man.
That's right. Nevertheless, he was the wonder of the schools. Plutarch tells us that fathers of his classmates would come to school to watch Cicero study.
Oh, man.
Because he was so prodigious in his talents. He made a name for himself as an orator and a lawyer early on, but then he ran afoul of Sulla, the strong man at the time, headed off to Greece to finish his education. Came back through the 70s, was popular as a pleader, and then 63 was his big moment.
That's right. This is the Catilinarian conspiracy, yeah, which we were talking about.
Right. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that, Jeff.
Well, Catiline and his cronies. There's still some mystery and disagreement about it, but the idea is that he was rising up and was going to overthrow the state.
Yes, and put up to it most likely by Marcus Crassus.
Crassus,
yeah,
exactly.
This is what Sallust tells us.
Yes. It's through really the machinations of Cicero that these great speeches survive, right?
Yeah.
He's ultimately shoved out, put down. Catiline himself is killed in battle.
That's
I believe,
at Pistoia, yeah.
And a number of his conspirators are rounded up by Cicero and summarily executed.
That's right. Quus quitandem abutere, et cetera,
yes,
as everybody knows.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so was he acting within the law or outside the law there?
Well, that's the kind of the fuzzy thing here.
Right.
He was exiled after this. I believe in that. Do I have my timeline right?
That's correct. Yep. Around 59.
But yes, he pushed through these executions, yeah, I think, outside of the law.
Right. Right up on the line.
Right up on the line to be the most charitable.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep.
Now, he was a hero to the people
for
the time. Again, Plutarch says when he spoke, lightning flashed from his fingertips and the crowd swayed back and forth rhythmically.
Yes.
But he wasn't a hero to some of the strongmen like those of the first triumvirate, Pompey, Crassus, Julius Caesar. They wanted him out of the way because he stood in the way of their plans.
Right.
So we move on from 63 down to, and the exile in 59 down to 49. Everyone knows this date, right? Caesar crosses the Rubicon, a little rivulet in north central Italy, and now there's civil war.
The die is cast.
That's right.
Yep.
Now there's civil war. He brings an army toward Rome, and Cicero has to choose between the brilliant tactician, Julius Caesar, and the guy who is at least formally, ostensibly more committed to Republican morals and ideals, but is obviously a dud.
That's right.
Pompey.
And Cicero chooses Pompey.
He chooses the dud.
Right.
Now, Pompey used to say, before this conflict started, he used to say, all I have to do is stamp my foot and all of Italy will rise up against Julius Caesar. Because he at one time was very popular.
Right. But now, his star is declining.
It didn't happen.
It did not happen.
He stamped and stamped and nothing happened.
There's so much stamping.
So he runs off to Brundisium. He's going to set sail to Dyrrachium on the Greek coast, Epirus. Cicero goes along with him. Then he escapes off to Greece. Eventually, we're talking about Pompey. He's beheaded in Egypt in 46. And now Julius Caesar is fully in charge.
Caesar did not want Pompey beheaded.
No,
no. It was presented as a gift to him. He was upset
by
this. But nevertheless, Caesar's the last man standing.
And then Caesar, in a great act of clemency, now think about this a moment. I like to tell my students this because I think it helps them realize some of the interplay here between personality and politics. Caesar then pardons all of those who resisted him in the Civil War.
That's right. That famous clemency.
It's putting your fellow citizen on the lowest possible rung. It's saying, I forgive you for opposing me.
Right. It's a weapon all of its own.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And in a world where status is everything.
Correct.
It's in some ways almost worse than death.
Yeah, it is the worst possible insult.
Yeah, yeah.
So now Julius Caesar then has a very short term as dictator for life.
Yes.
And is assassinated in 44.
The Ides of March. Where is Cicero in all of this? Where does this leave him?
Well, since 45, he's been in a literary retirement.
That's right.
He wrote the De Finibus and the other kinds of philosophical works. We talked about them a little bit in the last episode, but he has no role in politics anymore.
He certainly, you know, politically, would be in the conspirators' camp.
Definitely. He's on the side of the tyrannicides, Brutus and Cassius. He's definitely in favor of them, but he wasn't invited to the stabbing.
I know. I always hate it when I'm not invited to a stabbing. I mean, who doesn't like to be invited to a good old-fashioned stabbing, right?
Well, the RSVP is a little tricky.
It is a little tricky. But Cicero, he was not invited. I mean, it's complicated. He's politically speaking, he would be certainly on the side of the conspirators.
Definitely.
Right? He would be pro-stabbing. But the conspirators do not invite him into the fold.
Perhaps because they thought he would leak.
Right. And that's, I think that's part of that finger to the wind.
Right.
Personality that's been kind of a more recent interpretation of Cicero.
Mm-hmm.
They were afraid that, he's on our side, but he's bendable.
Who knows what's going to happen?
Right.
So you have a quote for us from one of Cicero's letters, number 108, I think, to Gaius Trebonius.
I mean, this is part of that great kind of eyewitness to history stuff we get from these letters. We get it in the moment, right? This is one of the most well-documented periods of all Roman history, of any history. And Cicero writes, "How I could wish that you had invited me to that most glorious banquet on the Ides of March." He expresses kind of after the fact that I wish I would have had a dagger in my hand.
Right. He describes it as a banquet.
A banquet, right.
An assassination as a feast.
As a feast.
To kill the man and carve him up is what Cicero is saying.
But how did Cicero really feel about Caesar? Did he really see him as a tyrant?
I think so, because in De Officiis, book 2, he has this to say. He says, "We recently discovered, if it was not known before, that no amount of power can withstand the hatred of the many. The death of this tyrant," he means Julius Caesar, "whose yoke the state endured under the constraint of armed force, and whom it still obeys more humbly than ever, though he is dead, illustrates the deadly effects of popular hatred."
Hmm.
So that's the Walter Miller translation. He says quite boldly, Julius Caesar was a tyrant.
Right.
And we're glad he's dead. So now, Jeff, there's a vacuum in power. Julius Caesar is off the stage. Who fills that vacuum?
Well, it kind of comes down to two guys. There's Antony, Mark Antony, who was Caesar's right-hand man.
Close friend, brilliant tactician.
Yes, in his own right. And looking at this on paper, it would look like he'd be the natural heir to what Caesar leaves behind. But Caesar has left in his will everything to his grandnephew.
That's right, his sister's grandson.
Grandson, yep. Yes, Octavian,
mm-hmm.
Who's just a kid.
19 years old.
And so it becomes a power struggle between these two guys. Who's going to take the mantle?
Yes. Later on, a third one was added well after this, a man named Marcus Lepidus.
Lepidus, yeah.
And became the second triumvirate, but he's really not in the picture yet.
Not yet. Well, I'm sure we'll cover these events in an episode later on.
Oh, yeah.
We've got to
have a good 37 consecutive episodes on the triumvirates.
That's exactly right.
But I would say.
We'll mention Lepidus and leave him off the stage for now.
So in this new conflict, which side did Cicero choose?
Well, once again, Cicero chooses poorly. He chooses against Antony. And it's ultimately that tension and enmity between those two guys that leads to his downfall and death.
So he chooses the right side in the sense that...
In the broad sense, yes.
That Octavian's the winner.
Right. But Cicero doesn't live to see that.
So, Jeff, what was Cicero's particular gripe against Mark Antony?
This has deep roots. It goes back at least a decade before Cicero's own death, right? I mean, it's more complex than we have time to get into today, but the roots really are in what's called the Bona Dea affair, the Good Goddess affair.
This is a little bit like Falcon Crest or Dynasty now?
Yeah, I would say heart to heart.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. But long story short, at Caesar's house, Caesar's wife was conducting a kind of a secret mystery ritual to this goddess. And this guy, Clodius, goes in drag to spy on the affair and maybe start conducting an affair with Caesar's wife. It's all very murky. Clodius is married to Fulvia, who ultimately is married to Antony. And it's Cicero who prosecutes Clodius in this affair and really lights the powder keg of this hatred.
This bad blood.
And it filters through. I mean, Fulvia, Antony's ultimately his wife, she hates Cicero perhaps even more than Antony does.
Mm-hmm. We'll hear from her later.
Yes, we will.
We'll have our Fulvia of it, right.
So it starts here, and it builds for a decade or more, right? Which gets us down to these famous speeches that Cicero writes and delivers against Antony, Cicero's Philippics.
Yes, in the last year of his life. So these are 14 speeches, which are really written against Mark Antony in Marcum Antonium. They were later called, at Cicero's urging, they were later called the Philippics in honor of Demosthenes.
And Demosthenes, an orator who wrote a number of speeches against Philip of Macedon, the original Philippics, a few hundred years before this. Yes.
Yeah, the father of Alexander the Great. So Cicero wrote these speeches. They weren't all delivered because they were literary compositions, but some of them were delivered, and they just excoriated Mark Antony.
The brutal stuff.
Absolutely brutal. We have a little quote here from the second Philippic, which is probably the most significant. It's translated by C.D. Young. And Cicero says, speaking to Mark Antony, "Shall we then examine your conduct from the time when you were a boy? I think so. Let us begin at the beginning. Do you recollect that, while you were still clad in the toga praetexta, you became bankrupt? That was the fault of your father, you will say. I admit that. You assumed the manly gown, which you soon made a womanly one. At first a public prostitute with a regular price for your wickedness, and that not a low one. but very soon Curio stepped in, who carried you off from your public trade and, as if he had bestowed a matron's robe upon you, settled you in a steady and durable wedlock.
Now, this is all really personal and insulting.
Highly salacious.
I can imagine, say, if Antony had a defense lawyer there, he would say, objection, Your Honor, relevance.
Correct.
So what exactly are the charges here?
Well, the Romans had a very different kind of legal system than we do. Relevance is all based on character, and here's how it worked. A guilty person does guilty things. A person of bad moral character is going to commit crimes. So you first have to establish that the person is generally morally bankrupt in the majority of their life, mm-hmm. then it's an easy thing to prove the particulars.
Cicero is going, he goes for the jugular here.
Exactly.
And goes back to Antony's childhood.
Standard fare.
Standard fare.
The three typical allegations of a Roman trial in the Republican era are these. The one is the defendant is a drunk, the second is the defendant is homosexual, and the third is that the defendant is guilty of incest.
This was almost expected.
Expected. It's not a matter of whether these are true, whether they constitute crimes in any sense. It's just this was how character was sullied.
That is fascinating.
And Cicero will hurl these accusations and have them hurled at him by all manner of persons.
Right. So there again, it's context is key. And so we can imagine, of course, Antony being very insulted by this, as I imagine, of course, he was.
But also laughing off.
Laughing it off, exactly.
Part right. of it.
It's expected.
Correct. Right. And taking a certain kind of begrudging admiration and Cicero's rhetorical fireworks, because this is just what you do. Antony himself did it, no doubt, in his speeches.
Sure.
On the prosecution.
Absolutely. So it comes down to Antony and Augustus, and they reach some sort of detente. And they're at the bargaining table, and they both have their lists of people that they want out of the picture, who they want to be proscribed, as the phrase goes, mm-hmm. and who's going to be rubbed out. And they're going back and forth, and they're coming up with this list of, you know, Andy says, well, if you're going to kill this guy, I get to kill this guy.
Right.
And at the end of this affair, they have a list of proscribed individuals.
In other words, time to wipe out personal enemies. So, Jeff, where was Cicero on this list?
Well, before we answer that question, why don't we hear from our sponsors?
This episode of Ad Nauseam is brought to you by Hackett Publishing. Since 1972, Hackett has been an independent publisher of high-quality translations in classics and other fields. Jeff, how do you feel about Hackett?
I've always loved their translations. I've used them for a long time in class, accessible. Students seem to like them. I love the artwork. It's clever. It's witty. These are books you can judge by their cover.
Absolutely. So here's the best part, Jeff. From now until December 31, coming up quickly, Ad Nauseam listeners can save a fat 20% on any order and receive
free shipping.
Free shipping,
yes.
From Hackett Publishing. What's the website?
HackettPublishing.com. Very simple.
That's pretty simple.
Yep.
What do they do when they get there?
They go there, they choose your text, you go to your checkout box, and you type in the coupon code AN2020.
What's that AN stand for?
Ad Nauseam.
And 2020 is the amount of books they're going to get?
It's that, and it's also the year.
It's the year.
Yes.
Okay. That's all they have to do?
That's it. That's a great deal.
That is a great deal. Listeners, thank you. Go to HackettPublishing.com, enter the coupon code AN2020.
You will not regret it. Today's episode is also brought to you in part by Ratio Coffee of Portland, Oregon. Ratio was born of a simple question. In the age of super premium espresso machines, why hasn't the automatic coffee maker evolved?
Well, now it has, Jeff, thanks to the work of Mark Helweg and the Ratio team. Tell us more, Jeff, about this Lamborghini of home coffee makers.
Well, the Ratio 8 and its little brother, the 6, are all made of premium quality materials, aluminum and stainless steel, high quality borosilicate glass, no plastic or other junk, and a heating element like the Space X. It comes with a 5-year warranty. Now, what kind of coffee maker gives you that? Dave, can you tell our listeners about the discount they can receive?
Yeah, I don't think any coffee maker gives them a 5-year warranty, but Ratio is offering 15% off their Ratio 6.
All right.
It's featured at places like Crate and Barrel, Williams Sonoma, but Ad Nauseam listeners can get a direct-to-consumer discount by going to Ratio Coffee, R-A-T-I-O, ratiocoffee.com, and entering our special code, A-N-C-O, that is Ad Nauseam Coffee, and they will get 15% off the Ratio 6 between now and March 20, 2021.
That's right. Go to ratiocoffee.com and enter special code ANCO for 15% off the Ratio 6.
Okay, Jeff, so to resume the question, where was Cicero on this list?
Well, I'm going to let Plutarch answer that question for us.
Good move.
And go right to the primary source. So he writes of Augustus and Antony's meeting. The prescription of Cicero, however, caused most strife in their debates, Antony consenting to no terms unless Cicero should be the first man be put to death, Lepidus siding with Antony, and Caesar holding out against them both. They held secret meetings by themselves near the city of Bononia for 3 days, coming together in a place at some distance from the camps and surrounded by a river. It is said that for the first 2 days, Caesar kept up his struggle to save Cicero, but yielded on the third and gave him up.
That's really fascinating. So Octavian held out, Octavian Augustus, for 3 days, but then eventually sold Cicero out to his enemies.
Right, so Cicero's a goner. Mm. So let's get down to the death itself and continuing on with Plutarch. You want to read a bit for us?
I do. This is again from Parallel Lives, Volume 7, the Loeb translation. Cicero landed and going to his villa lay down to rest. So now Cicero's down near Formiae, the spot of the assassination. To continue Plutarch, then most of the crows perched themselves about his window, cawing tumultuously, but one of them flew down upon the couch where Cicero lay with muffled head, and with its beak little by little tried to remove the garment from his face. But meantime his assassins came to the villa, Herennius, a centurion, and Papilius, a tribune, who had once been prosecuted for parricide and defended by Cicero.
Oh, man.
And they had helpers. After they had broken in the door, which they found closed, Cicero was not to be seen, and the inmates, that means the inhabitants, said they knew not where he was. Then, we are told, a youth who had been liberally educated by Cicero, and who was a freedman of Cicero's brother Quintus, Philologus by name, told the tribune that the litter was being carried through the wooded and shady walks towards the sea. I'll editorialize here a moment and say, he was betrayed by a philologist.
Yes, exactly right.
Can you believe
that?
The
only people on his side here are the crows.
Right.
They're trying to get him going.
The tribune, accordingly, taking a few helpers with him, ran round towards the exit, but Herennius hastened on the run through the walks, and Cicero, perceiving him, ordered the servants to set the litter down where they were. Then he himself, clasping his chin with his left hand, as was his habit, looked steadfastly at his slayers, his head all squalid and unkempt, and his face wasted with anxiety, so that most of those that stood by covered their faces while Herennius was slaying him. For Cicero stretched his neck forth from the litter and was slain, being then in his 64th year. Herennius cut off his head, by Antony's command, and his hands, the hands with which he wrote the Philippics. For Cicero himself entitled his speeches against Antony Philippics, and to this day the documents are called Philippics.
Plutarch's good, isn't he?
Absolutely.
And it's a very moving scene. Those little details about Cicero clasping his chin, it really paints a picture. It's brutal the way that he's betrayed here. He's betrayed by a freedman of his brothers. He's betrayed by someone he once defended in court.
Yeah, two men.
Two men, yes. Yeah, it's an awful, awful scene.
So Plutarch wrote this in Greek about 150 years after the event. We have some other sources for this, don't we, Jeff?
We do. Cassius Dio is another main source for this event, and he agrees with the Plutarch on the particulars, but he talks about what happens to Cicero's body after his death. So Cicero's head is removed, his hands are removed, and they're sent back to Rome, where they are displayed in the Forum.
Hmm.
And I'll pick it up here where Cassius Dio takes the story. He writes, "When, however, the head of Cicero was also brought to them one day," this would be to Antony and his wife Fulvia, "he had been overtaken and slain in flight. Antony uttered many bitter reproaches against it, and then ordered it to be exposed on the rostra more prominently than the rest." So this is right downtown Rome in the Forum. "In order that it might be seen in the very place where Cicero had so often been heard declaiming against him, together with his right hand, just as it had been cut off. And Fulvia, his wife, took the head into her hands before it was removed, and after abusing it spitefully and spitting upon it, set it on her knees, opened the mouth, and pulled out the tongue, which she pierced with the pins that she used for her hair, at the same time uttering many brutal jests."
That's gruesome.
Gruesome scene.
I can't even get the words out. It's grotesque.
It is grotesque, right. I think there's another version that talks about Antony keeping the head on his table and kind of laughing gleefully there as it's a kind of a grotesque dinner companion.
What did they say about revenge, the dish that's best served cold?
Exactly. He had the head on the platter.
Yeah.
There.
Taunting him, right? Cicero,
right.
Declaim now. Let's hear your Philippics.
Let's hear what you got now.
Well, thankfully, Jeff, we didn't have to witness any of that firsthand, but we did get to see the site of Cicero's tomb.
We did. This was in January, late January in 2016.
Yes, I think it was a cloudy Monday.
Cloudy Monday. You remember it was a Monday?
No, I don't. I checked Google Calendar.
Oh, wow. I appreciate that precision.
Well, we left the hotel. What was that name again?
It was in Rome. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was in Rome. It was not the Hotel Fulvia. I'll think of it in a minute.
Yeah.
We took the Termini.
Gioberti. Yeah, that's
right. Yeah. Named after the Gothic painter, right?
That's right.
We took the train from Termini with, I think, about four or five students.
Yeah.
Some hearty souls.
It was a free day, right?
That's right. Yep. Interested in some Ciceroniana.
Yeah. Do you remember whose idea it was to go down there? Was it
probably mine.
Probably being the Cicero guy?
I take credit for good ideas.
Okay.
My children tell me, so... We took the train. We went down, left about 8 o'clock in the morning. It's a 2.5-hour train ride.
Something
maybe
like
not
that.
Quite that long.
Mm-hmm.
You think you can get to Pompeii in 3 hours. This is a little more than halfway, if memory serves. We get off and set the scene for the vast majority of listeners, I think all of them, who weren't there.
I remember it was very sleepy. I mean, this is January, so it's not the high tourist season, but this is a small seaside town. There was not a lot going on. Most of the shops and restaurants were closed.
We did get an espresso, I remember.
We did, but it was difficult to get an espresso.
Yeah, not easy. We espressoed all over Italy, if memory serves.
That's right, we did. And we wandered around for a bit with the students, and I think there was two things that we wanted to check out. There's these rumors of Cicero's villa being there, and then more famously, his tomb.
I remember a third item, too,
and
there's a stretch of the Via Appia there that's exposed.
Oh, right, yeah. So it was a great little spot. There was nobody else around.
No, not in January.
So my sense is this is, even in the high season, these things are not huge tourist attractions.
No, definitely not. I've been there twice subsequent to 2016 in the summers of 17 and 18. That would have been July both. It's a little bit more busy there, and the beach is fabulous.
My sense is that people in the summer are there for the beach, right?
Yes, but Italians, not tourists.
Oh, no, oh, really?
I didn't see anyone else who looked like a tourist other than the group I was with.
That's really interesting.
Maybe there were some European tourists, but it's a gorgeous spot right there on the Tyrrhenian Sea. It's really, really pretty.
It is. It's you can see why Cicero and other people like him would want their villas there.
Yeah, not far from there was Baiae, which was like the Beverly Hills.
Right.
Or whatever the beach equivalent of Beverly Hills is.
Right. One of Nero's palaces still survives in some state there.
Correct.
Yeah.
So we start hunting for the tomb of Cicero.
Well, do you remember we asked around about the villa first,
okay.
which even has a more dubious provenance perhaps than the tomb. And I remember a local guy kind of pointed us down, and we did see kind of this derelict villa, which is known as the Villa Rubino, but by kind of, you know, local folklore, it's Cicero's villa.
All I know is I was taking pictures.
Yeah. We couldn't get inside. I've been doing some reading that it's about to collapse. There wasn't much to see there, but any connection with Cicero is dubious at best.
And then we walked a little bit further north along the Via Appia, students still in tow, still dedicated to all things historical.
And then we headed up to the tomb itself. Which is, if I remember, it's a bit of a walk, kind of up from the city, a bit north of the city.
About a half mile, I would say.
Yeah. And we come upon the tomb, and what does it look like?
Well, it is a precinct, kind of. There's an entire tomb precinct. Now, the first time you and I were there, we didn't get inside the gate.
No, it was gated off. It was locked.
The second time, when I was with Mrs. Noe, this would have been 2017, in the summer, we did manage to get inside.
Was it just open?
The locusts were making a terrible ruckus. The sun was bright, it was a beautiful day, and the gate was open. So we walked inside. It's built on a square base. The tower itself originally 80 feet in height, 79 feet. It's quite impressive. It's not really like a tholos. It doesn't have that much mystique, grandeur, but it is impressive to the eye nevertheless.
Yeah, we'll put some photos in the show notes so
Absolutely.
People can check it out. But it's a mixed bag in terms of kind of when these elements of the so-called tomb were put together, right? The tower itself is a much later addition, 10th century, I think I read is an estimate. The base itself, kind of this square blocky limestone base, dates from the imperial period, possibly from Cicero's own day. Some of the other kind of the outlining walls around the precinct have that opus reticulatum, kind of that net-shaped pattern, which dates to the Augustan period. So there are parts of it that, you know, could date to or close to Cicero's day.
There's also really good evidence that Augustus had a fair amount of regret after Cicero's death.
Right.
So not only did he resist for 3 days, but he later made Cicero's son, the Marcus Tullius Cicero of Deoficiis fame, later made him a minor official in his administration.
It's easy to believe that he might have gone out of his way to commemorate the man.
Definitely.
To bury him properly, right? We don't know what happened to Cicero's head and hands. They went to the forum and probably met an ignominious end, tossed into the Tiber or whatever. I mean, one of the things that makes me doubt that this is his actual tomb is, Antony, what he would have done with the body, maybe desecrated.
Correct.
The sources don't tell us.
And it was sometime after that before Octavian came to full power.
Right.
12 years later, from 43 to 31.
It's a long time.
It is. Nevertheless, once Cicero is eliminated, it's not beyond the realm of speculation that Antony would have released the body.
That's true. That's true. I mean, if you look at there's very little that's written about this tomb, at least not much that I could find. I mean, I was looking for, an archaeological treatment of it. I just couldn't find anything.
No, there's nothing.
The consensus seems to be like a tomb of Cicero with giant fat quotes around that.
Right.
Right. We just simply, we don't know.
One of the interesting things about the Italian preservation of the site, though, is that it is not a tourist attraction. I don't think it gets hardly any visitors.
Was there anybody there when you went in 17 in the
no,
summer?
No, we open? Were the only ones there.
Was there even like a caretaker?
No.
The gate was just open.
The third time when the gate was locked, I tried to ring somebody, which, doesn't always work that well in Italy.
Yeah.
Tried to find some way to make our way inside. No success.
Going back to this three times, I mean, why?
Because
why?
I love Cicero.
Was it a moving experience for you to be there?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was. A lot of people take pilgrimages to the Holy Land, they go to Jerusalem, things like that. If you are a great fan of baseball, you might go to Wrigley Field or wherever the Yankees play. I really like Cicero, and I just wanted to see where he supposedly died in the spot. I was fascinated with the story from an early age.
No, I hear you. I mean, we've talked outside of the podcast about that kind of that power of place,
right?
And that just standing there and having the hair on the back of your neck stand up, there's just something kind of very mysterious about that.
Well, I had the same experience when I visited the island of Capri. This was in 2008 with another colleague, Dr. Ken Bratt. And Ken pointed out, St. Paul sailed right here between the island and the mainland on his way to Puteoli, where he then walked north all the way to Rome along the Via Appia.
Paul would have walked right past this monument,
Definitely.
Whatever it was.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So that is also impressive.
Yeah, I love that kind of stuff. I mean, one of the interpretations of the site that I'm drawn to is the site maybe not as his tomb, but as a site marking the place of his death. And the Greeks and the Romans have a history of doing that very kind of thing. So, the ancient Greeks set up these stone lions. Herodotus tells us that one was set up at Thermopylae, no longer there, at the site of the Battle of Chaeronea. That lion is still there.
Right.
And there's even this story that when Caesar was murdered, Augustus later marked the spot of his death in the Curia of Pompeii. We'll talk about this in another episode. And then sealed it up to commemorate not just the death of Caesar, but the exact spot where it happened.
Where he stood.
So if we're talking about Augustus wanting to honor Cicero, is it beyond the realm of possibility that he would have done the same thing for him?
But you were just saying, as we were prepping, that the site of the tomb, the supposed tomb, is south of Gaeta.
Yes.
One possible location for Cicero's villa, but it's north of the place that's identified now as his villa.
Right.
So if it's north, if he's fleeing, he turns left and heads north back toward Rome.
It doesn't make any sense, right? But we don't know where his villa was. That villa that is said to be his in Formiae. I mean, there's nothing really there. I think it's just an existent villa.
That was the Villa Rubino?
Rubino. Cicero was famously associated with the town, so the story starts that this is his, right? So we don't know. But right, if that is his villa, it wouldn't make any sense for him to turn back towards Rome.
No, he would have fled south.
Right.
Bigger mystery why he never escaped to Greece altogether.
Yeah, exactly. He
had
friends there.
The conflict between Antony and Octavian and then Brutus and Cassius, that didn't take place until 42. At Philippi, so not too long after this, when the tyrannicides died, Cicero could have beat a more hasty retreat off to Greece.
We're back to that opening quote. Maybe just deluded to the point that he thought it's still gonna come through.
Right.
But
put his trust in a 19-year-old Octavian.
Right.
That's really surprising.
Right.
Nobody could have predicted he would become so powerful.
Of course. There's a detail I think in another version of his death story that I believe he tries to flee by sea. Right.
Right.
And the waves push him back like three times. And so he's forced to flee by land, and that's where he's caught.
What about the legend of Tullia's tomb and her burial?
Oh, that's a really weird one, right? So there's a, I believe this dates back to the 15th century.
So Tullia is Cicero's daughter.
Cicero's daughter.
By his wife Terentia.
Yes. And so there's this claim that her tomb was found not far from this place. Although if you look at the sources for this, it's all over the map. But
sketch, as the young people would say.
It's very sketch, okay. or actually, as they're saying today, it's sus. Have you
as
heard that one?
They say in Italy, sketchissimo.
Exactly.
I have heard sus.
But it's this legend that her tomb was found, and not just found, but they opened it up, and her body was still there, uncorrupted, and there was still a lamp burning, kind of an eternal flame.
You don't find this plausible?
I don't find it plausible, right? It's a wonderful story.
He loved his daughter very dearly.
He did.
He was really devoted to her. Her death spurred his philosophical compositions. And also played a role in St. Augustine's conversion, as it turns out.
Is that right? I don't know that story.
Well, that's for another episode.
Yeah. I think you could probably also factor that into why he didn't flee to Greece. The death of his daughter really destroyed him.
It did.
It sapped him of life. Yeah, so I think of this, you know, it's one of these things where I'm always skeptical of this kind of stuff, you know, historically speaking, or, you know, evidence speaking, rightly so. But I want it to be his tomb.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to be the place that marks that. Like we were saying, that power of place and standing there.
Yeah, I also don't want it to be so far from the coffee shop because it's a pretty good walk.
It is, right? It would be nice if he had been killed closer to the cafe.
Yeah, maybe next time.
Maybe next time.
All right, Jeff, so we got to wrap this up now. And I really enjoyed this episode because, as you know, I'm a great fan of Cicero.
Yeah, and I loved it. I loved going back to that location. I mean, that was a really wonderful moment. It's one of my favorite moments of that trip that we did together.
I really enjoyed it. And in fact, if listeners are interested, they can go to adnauseum.com. And the photo that we have in the banner is you and I on the beach there.
That's right. Exactly right. Looking like we're enjoying ourselves very much, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Probably too much when we're supposed to be chaperoning, what, 30-some Calvin College students?
They had all wandered off on their own by that point. That's right. All right, so listeners, it would really help us if you can go to whatever platform you're using and leave a review, a nice comment about how much you're enjoying the episodes. If you want to contact us personally, you can write to dave@adnauseum.com or jeff@adnauseum.com. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. Give us some ideas for upcoming episodes. We want to hear it all.
We're also happy to announce that we have some Ad Nauseum-themed merchandise.
We do not.
Yes, go to our website, check out the link that says Lurch with Merch, and you can get an Ad Nauseum themed t-shirt at a low price.
For a low price.
Well, I don't know, but it's like leaving a tip, right? If you liked the show, leave a tip under your wine glass. Buy a t-shirt.
Buy a t-shirt. Wear it proudly.
Next week, we're going to be looking at horror vacui.
What does that mean?
Fear of emptiness.
Oh, I get that.
The Dipylon vase. This is a famous work of Greek art. We're going to be looking at the Dipylon vase and fear of emptiness.
Sounds great. Before we get out of here, we have a few people to thank here. We want to thank, as always, our sound engineer, Mishka Fernando, and all her great work.
Brilliant stuff.
Putting this all together. You wouldn't believe the kind of stuff that you don't get to hear. And it's in your interest to not hear those that kind of things. Another thanks to Scott Vinzen, who is behind the screaming guitar riffs that intro every episode. So, Dave, you got the gustatory parting shot this week, right?
I do. I'm going to take us out with this. This one is from the inimitable Mark Twain. Training is everything, he says. The peach was once a bitter almond. Cauliflower is nothing but cabbage with a college education.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.